KQED.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Stephen Cuevas in Los Angeles. State lawmakers could create a financial penalty for Californians who don't buy health insurance. This would replace the federal penalty that was eliminated in the Republican tax bill. KQED's health reporter April Dembosky explains.
The federal mandate to buy coverage will expire in 2019, and health officials say that could cause the price of premiums to rise 15% to 30%. That's why State Senator Ed Hernandez is considering a penalty just for Californians as a way to keep healthy people in the market and keep prices stable. Up to a dozen other states are considering a similar move. The mandate was the most unpopular piece of the Affordable Care Act, and the head of California's marketplace, Peter Lee, says a state penalty might help, but the market would still be okay without it. That's because California invests heavily in marketing that attracts healthy people to sign up. The carrot approach as opposed to the stick. For the California Report, I'm April Dembosky.
4 months ahead of the June primary, there's a new poll from the Public Policy Institute of California. It finds Democrats Gavin Newsom and Antonio Villaraigosa pretty much tied. KQED's politics editor Scott Schaefer tells us more.
Likely voters in the PPIC poll prefer Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom by 23% to 21% over former Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. 24% are undecided. Villaraigosa does best among Latinos and L.A. voters, while Newsom has a wide lead in the San Francisco Bay Area. In the U.S. Senate race, incumbent Dianne Feinstein leads her fellow Democrat, State Senator Kevin DeLeon, by 46% to 17%, with a third of voters undecided. Feinstein also has a huge advantage in campaign cash. If these trends hold, there will be no Republican candidates at the top of the statewide ballot in November, which could depress GOP turnout. For the California Report, I'm Scott Schaefer.
The only needle exchange program in Orange County closed its doors last month after Santa Ana officials denied its permit application. KQED's Michelle Wiley explains.
According to city officials, the application was denied for public health reasons after an increased number of discarded syringes were found around the Santa Ana Civic Center where the exchange operated. Permitting is now required because of a city ordinance passed in November. UC Irvine medical student and co-founder of the exchange, Kyle Barber, says the decision is devastating for their clients.
They're being forced to share needles. They're having to reuse them over and over again, even if they become bent and broken, which increases their chance of getting an abscess. We hear that people no longer have a way to dispose of their syringes. So closing the needle exchange perversely increases syringe litter, not decreases it.
State and national public health officials say sharing contaminated needles spreads bloodborne illnesses like HIV and hepatitis C. State health officials say Orange County has experienced a sharp increase in hepatitis C infections in recent years. Local agencies in Orange County say they have no current plans to distribute clean needles in place of the exchange. According to Barber, the volunteer organization exchanged more than 2 million syringes in its first 2 years of operation. He is currently working with the city of Santa Ana and state officials on next steps. For the California Report, I'm Michelle Wiley.
A federal judge has ordered Orange County to stop trying to clear homeless encampments along the Santa Ana riverbed. The decision comes after lawyers for the homeless requested an emergency stop to the sheriff department's plan to begin enforcing trespassing laws in the area. KPCC's Jill Replogle explains.
Earlier this week, sheriff's officials had confirmed plans to begin ticketing and possibly arresting homeless people for trespassing at the riverbed. But Judge David O. Carter put a stop to that, at least temporarily. Some 500 to 1,000 homeless people live in tents and makeshift shelters along the Santa Ana River bike trail, without bathrooms or other basic services. County officials say the area is not fit for human habitation and that the encampment is a public safety hazard. But their attempts to clear people out have been met with lawsuits from advocates for the homeless. They say the county's options for temporary shelter and emergency housing are woefully lacking. They also contend anti-camping laws in OC cities leave homeless people with nowhere else to go. Another lawsuit was filed this week alleging that the county has failed to offer appropriate shelter for disabled people camped along the river. A hearing in the first lawsuit before Judge Carter is scheduled for February 13th. Until then, the sheriff's department says it will continue to police the area for criminal activity but won't cite homeless people for trespassing. For the California Report, I'm Jill Replogle in Orange County.
As if it's not already hard enough to afford college tuition, turns out a lot of the state's college students also have a tough time paying for food and finding a place to live. The California State University system aims to change that, first by figuring out the extent of the problem, as KQED's education reporter Vanessa Arancano explains.
Like people around the Bay Area, a lot of San Francisco State students will tell you their housing situation isn't great.
So we have two people in the living room.
All five of us are paying $1,500 a month.
Two people in a small bedroom.
Paying $1,300 a month, living with a 69-year-old woman.
One person in an office.
We only have one bathroom.
One person in, like, a sunroom. It's pretty insane.
Those are students Alex Rogers, Alyssa LaGraff, and Katie Souza. Maybe their situations aren't ideal, but they've got a stable place to stay, which is more than a lot of students can say, according to the new study. It found almost 11% of CSU students have been homeless at least once in the last 12 months. That's more than 50,000 students. Drake Davis is one of them.
I had a little spot out there by the Creative Arts Building behind a yucca plant.
He slept there until the police spotted him and started asking questions.
Do you have any ID? And then I took out my San Francisco State student ID and they were kind of floored. They're like, oh, you're a student here.
He says he's since found a 10x5 storage locker a ways from campus and is living there. Davis is also among the nearly 42% of CSU students that the study found have a hard time getting enough quality food to eat. The study, which surveyed students at all 23 CSU campuses, found these housing or food insecure students are more likely to struggle academically. CSU has taken steps to address these issues. All the campuses now have food pantries. A handful accept food stamps, and more are starting to. And most of the schools have some emergency housing and financial assistance available. Now researchers say it's time to look at how well these services are working. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
Support for the California Report comes from Collective Health. Through technology, design, and human support, Collective Health offers companies and their people a new way to experience health benefits. CollectiveHealth.com. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. And the Barracuda Networks, network application, content, and data security solutions for physical networks and public cloud platforms. Learn more at barracuda.com/products.
Drug-fueled private sex parties, deals getting done in strip clubs and hot tubs, it's just part of doing business for some of Silicon Valley's elite entrepreneurs and investors. That's according to a new book from Bloomberg news anchor Emily Chang called Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. She says behind all the tawdriness going on in multi-million-dollar mansions and posh resorts, there's also a daily work culture rife with allegations of intimidation, sexism, and outright harassment. Well, I'm wondering first what you're trying to get at with the name of the book, Brotopia. I mean, after reading excerpts, it would seem to me to mean a utopia for men who want to behave badly.
Then you got my point. In my mind, Brotopia perfectly captures this idea of Silicon Valley as a modern utopia where anyone can change the world. Anyone can make their own rules if they're a man. But if you're a woman, it's incomparably harder. And if you look at the numbers, it shows. You know, women hold 25% of computing jobs. They account for 7% of venture investors. And women-led companies get 2% of venture capital funding.
Well, how does that attitude and this kind of behavior manifest itself in this kind of workplace social life dynamic, meaning where the boundaries between work and one's personal life can get kind of blurry?
So first of all, you're starting with workplaces that are incredibly male dominated. And, you know, I spoke to a number of women. I had 12 women over for dinner at my home, many of them engineers, as I write about in the book. And they're exhausted. They're tired and frustrated about being the only woman in the room over and over again. But the great news is that they love their jobs. They love changing the world. But, you know, these workplaces need to improve to make these spaces more comfortable and hospitable for women. I conducted this dinner about 3 weeks after Susan Fowler wrote her explosive blog post. This is an Uber engineer who was propositioned for sex by her manager on her first day on the job. And when she told Human Resources, they said, "We're going to let that slide because he's a high performer." Women engineers at Uber told me that they were routinely invited to strip clubs and bondage clubs in the middle of the day, and that there were kegs open on the floor all day long, and it was a heavy drinking culture. And, you know, part of the problem with how Silicon Valley operates is that so much business is happening outside the office, whether it is at the bar or the hotel lobby or the conference or the party. And that can lead to blurred lines, especially when you're talking about an investor alone with a female entrepreneur. And that entrepreneur may think, well, he wants to invest in my business, and he may just be trying to get her into bed. You know, this is part of a culture and how Silicon Valley has operated for far too long.
Emily Chang is Bloomberg Tech host, executive producer, and the author of Brotopia. The new owner of the LA Times is also one of the richest men in Los Angeles. Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong made his fortune in medical research and development and in pharmaceuticals, but he has virtually no experience in journalism. So why would Soon-Shiong want to own a major metropolitan newspaper in today's contracting news market? We turn to USC Annenberg School of Journalism professor Gabriel Kahn for some answers. He met and interviewed Soon-Shiong for a recent profile in Los Angeles Magazine. So why would someone like Dr. Soon-Shiong want to buy the LA Times in the first place?
Hopefully the answer to that question is that he really understands that there's a civic value to supporting a robust news operation in a city like Los Angeles, and that he believes that reporting can hold institutions accountable. The other reason could be, which would be a little bit more disturbing, is that he sees some synergy with his publicly traded healthcare company, and that he thinks that having a big publishing operation could in some way assist that. That would be sort of a red flag.
For those who don't know the kind of immediate short history of the LA Times and the troubles it's gone through, can you explain that a little bit and explain what kind of LA Times that the doctor is taking on?
So for the past decade, really, the LA Times has been passed back and forth between different owners. It's been in and out of bankruptcy. And with each sort of successive twist and turn in this saga, things have only really gotten worse. There has been no investment in the newsroom. The most recent owner, the chairman of the parent company called Tronc, came up with a whole bunch of different schemes about how he was going to turn the paper around. None of them came to fruition. The newsroom got so frustrated that they voted to unionize a few weeks ago. The former publisher was sent packing because there was a series of sexual harassment allegations against him. So it's really been rocky all the way through. You know, amazingly, they still put out a paper every day, and it's often of quite high quality.
So this sale means the Los Angeles Times is now at least back under local control. Should longtime subscribers and Times staff breathe a sigh of relief?
So that's generally always been good for a newspaper. And the other important thing is that it's no longer part of a publicly traded company. That's really been difficult for newspapers lately because, of course, it takes a lot of investment and patience to turn these companies around. So you've got somebody with very deep pockets. He has paid a huge premium for the Los Angeles Times. Now we're waiting for him to pronounce what his aims are and what he feels he's bought and why.
Gabriel Kahn is a professor at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism. Gabriel, thanks a lot for coming on this morning.
Thank you, Stephen.
And finally today, Governor Brown's famous Delta Tunnels plan that would pipe water from Northern California to Southern California has now been reduced to just one tunnel. Brown's office announced the scaled-back version of the plan yesterday, saying one tunnel would ease environmental concerns and allow the project to raise more funds. The single water tunnel would still be the state's largest water project in decades. And that's the California Report for Thursday, February 8th, a production of KQED Public Radio. From KQED's Los Angeles Bureau, I'm Stephen Cuevas.